My name is Jim Carbone, representing the Department of Administrative Services, and I'll be covering an outline of the governor's recommendations for this portion of the Department of Higher Education budget. I'll be speaking from an outline that's typical of those that we've been using. Looks like this. To start with, I want to remind again the committee, your staff mentioned this at the outset, that House Bill 5022, which is before us today, is funds just a portion of the Department of Higher Education's budget. And it's those activities involved in instruction and research and public service, operating costs at the seven institutions. It also includes debt service for payment on bonds that have been used for capital construction projects. This bill also includes the sports action lottery. And finally, it includes estimates of the non-limited expenditures for self-support activities. Not included in House Bill 5022, but part of the Department of Higher Education are the statewide public services, which are the Agricultural Experiment Station, the Extension Service, and the Forest Research Laboratory. They are being heard in House Bill 5057.
Madam Chair, may I interrupt just for a moment? I see a friend in the back of the room getting ready to walk out the door, I think. Former State Representative Chuck Norris.
Oh, yeah.
Hello.
Chuck Norris.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you.
So anyway, I just wanted to remind you to point out that this is just a portion of the higher education budget. The governor's revised budget continues all existing programs for the Department of Higher Education. In addition, the governor recommends an additional $73 million in general funds on top of the current service level. And we've already been briefed on the kinds of things that are included to be funded in that $73 million. They are the tuition freeze or the resident undergraduate instruction fee freeze, the core of the first phase of the new model development that the department's been explaining to you. Additional funding is provided to encourage enrollment growth, particularly in high-demand areas, and additional funding is provided for faculty recruitment and retention. Yesterday, there was some discussion about how much of the $116 million, which has been described as the full model implementation approved by the Board of Higher Education, how much of that $116 million is included in the governor's $73 million recommendation, and the answer is $67.6 million of the $73 million is part of the $116 million.
Sure. Does that include the tuition freeze, or is that exclusive of the tuition freeze?
Madam Chair, Senator Toe, that includes the tuition freeze.
Okay. So if you take the tuition freeze out, then it's something like 44 or something like that that's in the model itself. Or does the tuition freeze have to be considered part of the model?
Madam Chair, Senator Troll, I'm not certain that it has to be considered a part of the model. However, in the model that was crafted by the Board of Higher Education at the $116 million level, part of that was a freeze on undergraduate resident instruction fees.
Okay. So it's a part of the tuition freeze is on 116.
Yeah. Okay. That is correct, Madam Chair. Senator Cohn. The elements that are included, if we just look at that, in the middle of my page, the overview, the tuition freeze, the second bullet there at $15.3 million, you might want to write these down next to them. The first phase of the new budget model implementation at $47.3 million. And then the last bullet, the additional funding for faculty recruitment at $5 million. Those three elements add up to the $67.6 million and are also included in the $116 million figure approved by the Board of Higher Education.
And I'm sure.
Yes. Representative Ross.
Could you just say those for use again?
Certainly. Tuition freeze at 15.3, model implementation at 47.3, and faculty recruitment and retention at 5.0 million.
And then the balance between that and the 73 million is the additional funding to encourage enrollment growth in targeted disciplines.
Madam Chair, Representative Ross, that's correct. That the $160 million was based on enrollment at a given point in time, I believe the 98-99 school year, so there was no enrollment change in those figures.
Okay. Madam Chair, what I'm actually asking here is what is the difference between $67.6 million and $73 million pay for? What's that extra little blob there pay for?
Madam Chair, Representative Ross, that $5.4 million would pay for additional enrollment growth at the seven institutions.
Thank you.
The next part of my presentation is just to walk you through very quickly the standard budget buildup format that we have applied to all state agencies to ensure that they're on an equal playing field when we develop their budget, starting with the legislatively adopted budget at approximately $1.8 billion total fund. I need to make a correction. I just noticed here a few minutes ago that the full-time equivalent positions is wrong as it's written on the sheet. It's not 7746.47. It should be 8082.85. 8082.85. That was the legislatively adopted budget FTE, and that includes the program units. If you got into the budget, would be the educational and general program unit and the memo budget, but I excluded the memo budget when I looked at 7746. Emergency abort actions then were taken into account to adjust that legislatively adopted. Four emergency board actions occurred through April 1998. In January 98, the Department of Higher Education came before the emergency board and requested the $5 million for the Oregon Engineering Education Investment Fund. This is related to Senate Bill 504 that was adopted by the last legislative session. Appropriating $5 million, the Board of Higher Education went back and worked with its constituents and derived a plan for expenditure of those funds and came to the January Emergency Board to receive allocation of that money. In November 97, the Department of Higher Education came to the Emergency Board requesting additional funding for the Oregon Wide Area Network, also known as OWNED. That was $1.4 million. In January 98, they received employee compensation cost increases. And then in April 98, an emergency board action transferred $1.15 million from debt service to the capital construction program unit of the Department of Higher Education. And basically, that was to help fund the urban center at Portland State University. So those are actions that occurred and affected the budget buildup.
Sure. Sure. Excuse me. Do these emergency board actions become part of the base, and do they roll up into the future?
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Trow, all of these four emergency board actions do become part of the base and roll up. There are adjustments made further on in the budget development. For example, the debt service adjustment in the next category of adjustments we look at the actual cost of anticipated debt service and adjust to make sure that the department, in fact, will have sufficient debt service available for the next meeting. At the top of the next page are those additional adjustments, which adjust for position and inflationary increases, and that includes, again, looking at debt service to ensure that they have the capital on hand for that.
Madam Chair, thank you. How much was included or added in emergency action for the employees' compensation cost increases?
Madam Chair, Representative Winters, that was $12.2 million.
Is that the first?
Madam Chair, that was compensation adjustments that occurred during the current biennium. It was not directly related to PERS action. Thank you, Madam Chair. Going on, other budget adjustments to get to a current service level included phase outs of one-time expenditures. Last legislative session, there was $100,000 appropriated for the Western Governors University and $50,000 appropriated for the Pacific Program at the University of Oregon, one-time appropriation. So those were excluded then from the budget, do not roll up. And Dan,
I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I know what the Pacific Program was. Can you guys? Maybe we can ask later. But.
Madam Chair, Senator Troy, it's a leadership program for managers. Actually, I believe Senator Gordley is very familiar with it, probably more so than I am. Mm-hmm. But it's ongoing as far as I know. It did receive an additional appropriation though last session.
Okay, so you're phasing out one-time expenditures, so it's in the budget now, so it is sort of recovered in the future.
Madam Chair, Senator Crowe, that one-time $50,000 extra appropriation is not in the next week.
But there is money in the budget for the program.
Senator Chair, Representative Crowe, I believe that there is, but that would be a question for the University of Oregon because it would be funded on campus.
Madam Chair. I would just add that this is an exemplary program. It's a leadership training opportunity for state and local government managers. The program that I participated in last October was a class of approximately 42 folks from around the state, and we're gathered for a week. It's an intensive training, and you're exposed to some of the greatest people in our country who are focused on leadership development. It's a magnificent opportunity for our state employees and also for local government personnel, and I would like more clarity on what is in the U of O budget to maintain this program, because I think it is something we should continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Those are the steps that we took, just in general steps, to get to a current service level for this department. Above that are, for your consideration, the policy packages that are recommended by the governor. Package 102 is the base budget buildup. That's the core budget model implementation. 103 is the freeze on undergraduate instruction fees. Package 110 would authorize the use of certificates of participation by the department for the purchase of equipment. This is something that the agency has done in the past. Package 150 is the targeted enrollment. This is the enrollment piece to fund additional enrollment, particularly high demand disciplines. Package 151 is recruitment and retention, $5 million. Package 444, transfer of deferred maintenance. This is actually a movement of funds between program units. I remember I said that not all of the Department of Higher Education's budget is reflected in this House Bill 5020, and that the capital construction budget for 5021 will be heard at a later date. What this does is move $12 million, about $12.1 million of operating and maintenance funds out of this part of the budget and into the capital construction budget. And that allows the department to use those funds to generate, to bond under the Oregon Constitution, Article 11G, the department can receive authorization from the legislature to sell general obligation bonds or capital construction type projects, provided they are matched on a one-to-one basis with general fund appropriation. And so this allows us to do that. Package 446, transfer of the regional access. This moves funds for post-secondary education partnerships from the Department of Higher Education into the Office of Community College Services, and you may remember when you reviewed the Office of Community College Services seeing that $6 million come in. And finally, package 975, the capital improvement package, authorizes a couple capital improvement projects. That then is the basis of the governor's recommended budget. There's a number of revisions at the bottom of the page, most of them technical in nature, but I want to go through them very quickly. First, just packages 102 and 150 for better balance is the way I put it here. Basically, 102 is the base model implementation. And 150, package 150, as you see, is targeted enrollment. The Board of Higher Education, as they tweak the model here, in the last couple of months, have determined that about 5.4 million will fully fund an enrollment growth of what they're targeting is 1,098 FTE over student FTE over the biennium, and that should be sufficient. So they are recommended moving part of package 150 out of that package and up into the base budget buildup to allow them to have a little bit more support for capitalization of the model. So what we're talking about is reducing package 150 by 2.6 million and increasing package 102 by a similar amount. So basically this is just a transfer between packages as the Board of Higher Education more finely tunes this budget model. Other adjustments include probably the largest adjustment in dollar terms is a reflection of direct student loan expenditures. And this is really a non-limited expenditure. This is an estimate of the amount of direct student loans that will be made through the institutions of the Department of Higher Education. About 4 years ago, I might be off a year or two, the federal government started making direct student loans through the Federal Department of Education directly to institutions. And prior to that, most student loans were made by private lenders guaranteed by guaranteed agencies. The one here in Oregon would be the State Scholarship Commission. More and more institutions have been moving to this direct student loan type of arrangement. That means that there's more money moving through the institutions, and this is kind of an accounting change and recognizes the fact that now that activity is occurring on the campuses.
Do you know what the rate of on the student loans, how many get paid back? What's the rate on that? Do you have any idea?
Madam Chair, I don't, but I'm certain there's someone behind me that does, and that will be forthcoming.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to ask a question about your certificates of participation here on package 110. Is there a limit, a cap, on how much the COP can be used in this particular situation? I know you're in package 444, you're using an ability to bond.
But just wondering on package 110, what determines the level of utilization of COPs?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, all COPs are controlled by the Department of Administrative Services. We issue those instruments on behalf of the agencies. Controlling factors are two. First of all, your authorization to the Department of Higher Education, in this case for $8.86 million of expenditure limitation, controls the expenditure of those funds. The other controlling is how much debt can be accrued. DAS has a bond limit bill, and I believe the COPs are included in that, and one of the committees here will review that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to the adjustment that was made in 102 and 150. One, when was this budget revised? Is this, when was that change made? Is that in recently or?
It would be February 1st.
Mr. Chair,
Chairman, for the record.
Thank you.
I'm starting to learn. That the board during the month of February considered. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Phil Anslo. I work in the Chancellor's office as hard as I can. The change was made during the month of February and March as the board looked at a series of options. At the original $116 million level as we cast, the $100 million level that was talked about in terms of the Senate budget, and the governor's budget of 73, we went down through in a fair amount of detail what the trade-offs were under each of those options, and the sense of the board was to try to push as much as possible towards the recapitalization. Obviously, we want to serve as many students as we can, but we also want to try to get the recapitalization amount as high as possible. So the boards, and this was a budget exercise that didn't result in allocations, Representative Edwards, but rather a what if under various scenarios. So it was an opportunity for the board to look at what the governor was recommending and make some a tentative proposal based on those limitations.
So I can follow up. I have two questions. One relative to that adjustment. I guess what I kind of goes to a fundamental question of in package 102, the $44.7 million as described here, why wasn't it contemplated that you could actually use the money that's now, and you're saying that, quite frankly, by wrapping the two, by putting $5.4 million up into there, is that money then going to be dedicated for the same purposes as was described in package 150, or is it now going to be used as some base, which therefore is different? And then the option obviously is 2.6. I guess the fundamental question for me is, why did you separate out the two from the beginning, unless there's some completely separate use? I mean, couldn't you use the money in 102 for the purposes in 150?
Chair Minutes, Representative Edwards, apparently as a part of the process in our policy package request to the governor and the way the governor outlines it in terms of his recommendation to you, we separated out that which was enrollment growth from that which was a fundamental funding of the model, including the provision for an undergraduate tuition freeze. When the board brought those budgets forward to the governor, we had a policy option package of $116 million, including the tuition freeze, as implementation of the model. We also had an estimate of enrollment demand, which is a separate policy package. My recall is it was on the order of $30 million in state funds for what we saw as a rather dramatic increase in the enrollment. As the governor's recommendation came forward, the governor proposed the $8 million,
the governor's recommendation proposed the $8 million to fund sim enrollment, and the recommendation of 44-7 to implement the model on a phased basis. The governor has indicated a willingness to support the full implementation of the model, I believe, over a two-biennium period, and I'd rather have the representative from the Department of Administrative Services speak to that. But that was the background that led to the separate policy packages that the governor brought forward.
I would like to reinforce that, because I didn't say that the governor does fully support a phased-in approach, a two-biennium approach of that. And Representative Edwards, you were out when I mentioned what the roll-up was, and since that was kind of your question yesterday, I wanted to restate that the governor's recommended budget includes $67.6 million of the $116 million full model implementation. Now, that does not include any adjustments up or down for enrollment, but the $116 million does not either. So roll-up on that portion alone would be then the difference between 116 and 57.6. So the roll-up for next biennium would be about $48.4 million on that portion, the core portion of the model implementation.
Madam Chair, one last thing.
Yes.
Maybe this is more to staff. I've been confused about the 116, the 100, and the 73, and whether those are all apples-to-apples comparison. I'm not quite sure under each of those items what's contained. I just heard at least Christian Freeze was part of 116. I'm not sure what else was involved other than is that supposed to, if they had their way, Package 102 would be 116, or would it be something less with, I guess I'm trying to figure out, if you added up all these option packages, is that 116? And maybe at some point we could get a sheet that shows 116, the 100, and the 73, because 73 really isn't the model. It's 44, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Edwards.
I'll go and then let you go.
On the front of my page, you can almost make an outline of what's included in the governor's recommended budget that is also included in the $116 million. And that is the tuition freeze at $15.3 million, second bullet under overview. The first phase of the new budget model implementation, which is now in the governor's revised budget, $47.3 million. And then the bottom bullet there, additional funding provided for faculty recruitment at $5 million. So those three items are common to items in the $116 million.
And this is to staff. Maybe you could give us a breakout of how you add up the 116 to 100 and into 70. I'm sorry. It must be me, but these numbers should be thrown around, and I'm not sure what's all included in them.
Yeah.
I could quite follow that.
I think that'd be great.
We'll put together. Okay.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to very quickly finish my presentation and. The technical adjustments, there's a number of them listed there, and I noticed that there are two that did not get on this page, so let me at least state them on the record. One that didn't get put on this page was the additional other fund limitation to recognize tuition income from the additional enrollment that will come from Package 150, the targeted enrollment. So as additional students come to the institutions, they will bring with them tuition, so we need an additional expenditure limitation for that.
Madam Chair, if I may interrupt again, I guess this is going to do introductions. There is another former state representative in the back of the room, and that's Representative John Menas. It's great to see you this morning.
See, I'm testifying. I'm wandering.
We're far there, aren't we?
We hope not.
Are you against spending money?
Yeah.
And the final Madam Chair, the final technical adjustment, then I'll let you move on, is that there's a shift of that portion of the continuing education funds that are currently in the non-limited account, these are being shifted into the limited account to make them consistent with the way other funds have been counted.
Manager, can you just say that again?
Continuing education, which are like summer sessions and off-hour sessions, traditionally have been considered a self-support activity, and so the funding has not been a limited expense in the department's budget. We are moving now toward recognizing equal funding of all student FTEs. So to recognize that, we're moving those funds that are associated with continuing education from non-limited to limited.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Wilson?
Thank you. Jim, I can dig through the reams of paper here to find the definitions that I wrote down on other funds, excluding lottery and other funds non-limited. Is it possible for you to give me just a very brief, generic rundown on what those categories include? If it's far too big, I'll do my research. But could we take just a couple of seconds for you to help me fill in?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, so we're talking about what types of revenues might be included in limited other funds.
Yeah, I don't want to take too much committee time if that's going to be a death march for us, so I'll be happy to dig through this.
And it shouldn't be, I won't get into all the detail, but can provide you the majority of it in this appropriation bill would be tuition.
Mm-hmm. Okay. On other funds excluding lottery?
Excluding lottery, right, correct. Yeah. There are a number of other categories, but certainly tuition is far and away a large portion.
If I may follow up, where did research fit in and revenue raised from dormitories?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, those the large proportion are in the non-limited other fund category.
Thanks.
Jim,
Representative Wynn?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, just to follow up that on the limited funds, excluding lottery, some federal funds are also in that category, are they not?
Madam Chair, Representative Winters, there are, and I didn't. Certainly, there's a lot of different kinds of income coming in. But,
thank you.
But you're correct. There are some federal funds in there.
Other questions?
I'm confused.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Joe Fox, National University System, and I'm Representative Minnis got away before I could share a piece of history with you. In my office, there's something that is legend known as the Minnis Rule. I remember as a brand new president in company with a chancellor being summoned into when you tell me something or give me something, it has to be something I can explain in 50 minutes on the fairway of the state fair. Yeah. And that is in my office known as the Minnis Rule. Answering a question that was raised earlier about the rate of default on student loans, I'm pleased to tell you that in Oregon that default rate is about 4%. Nationally, for public universities and colleges, it is somewhere between 7-7.5. For the independents, it's approximately 6. For the community colleges, it's approximately 14. And for the technical and proprietary schools, about 22%. So Oregon students meet their obligations and pay those back at below the with a default rate below the national average. Chair Minister, members of the committee, I want to just simply make a few introductory remarks for today. Yesterday, we shared with you a lot of information about the operational mechanics of this new model and the transformation that we're engaged in. And you heard from presidents regarding their commitment to this brave new world of flying airplanes while you're building them, and because to a significant extent, that's what we're about. You heard from those presidents also concerns about a healthy start for every institution, and we share that. Today, you're going to hear from the people who actually have to make this work. And I think that's important, that you meet vice presidents and the chief academic officers, the provosts, and you meet faculty who are actually into how will we make this happen. We're going to move from a cost-driven, steady state, rear-view mirror, risk-adverse world, operating world, to a proactive, entrepreneurial, if you like, focused on investments and student-oriented model that requires our taking some chances. And the decisions about taking those chances and moving toward a results-based set of outcomes means that we've got to have the very best talent focus on that. Because there's no way in blazes that a single chancellor and a few vice chancellors and the board can do this alone. So we need the brain power of the very best on our campuses as we chart these new waters, because we feel a little bit like Christopher Columbus. It's exciting. But out there be monsters, as the map used to say, and so we move ahead. Well, what I'd like to do is to have Bill Anslow come back, and he'll be joined by people from Portland State, from Eastern, from OSU, from U of O, and then you'll hear from a faculty representative, and then we'll throw it open to questions. But we're going to get this morning into the details of people who must actually make this work.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Anslow. Vice Chancellor for Finance Administration in the Chancellor's Office. I'd like to invite forward, starting with George Pernsteiner, who's the Vice President for Administration at the Portland State University campus. George?
Thanks,
In the interest of time for the committee, if the two provosts would join me, Provost Bruce Shepherd from Eastern Oregon University and Provost Roy Arnold from the Oregon State University, sort of sandwich the two provosts who are between us, and then a little bit later we'll ask Vice President Dan Williams to join us. What we try to present to you today is how these gentlemen and their counterparts on the other campuses will begin to look at this new model and hopefully the funding that is necessary to make it work. And we want to deal with it in terms of five topics: recapitalization, access to educational opportunities, some potential new investments, our ability as higher education to contribute to the economy, the issue of performance funding is an element of it as well, which is starts with board control, as I mentioned in yesterday's testimony, of 0.5% of the state general funds as a starting point for performance funding. The targeted enrollment we've already talked about, I think, in terms of engineering technology, computer and information science, as well as teacher education. And we also have talked a little bit about the tuition freeze, and these gentlemen will as well, and the issue of regional or geographic access, I think Provost Shepherd will touch on. What I'd like to do is turn to, and your books, I think, contain these slides, the slide books for day three. The issue of recapitalization is kind of a word that needs a little bit of definition, I think. What we're talking about is trying to rebuild and strengthen each university so that they can move ahead, as Chancellor Cox has said, and we need sufficient funding to meet ongoing costs. And recall that yesterday we talked about the fact that we're moving from a cost-based approach more towards a revenue-based approach, and there can still be issues of cost that pop up, and I think these folks will talk about that a little bit, so that you're not free from due bills that might come in. We need also in this new environment, because the provosts and presidents will be taking risk as they get into starting new programs and possibility of enrollment fluctuations, and that's particularly sensitive, I think, on the, at the smaller campuses, an adequate faculty recruitment and retention fund, but also for us, as President Reno talked about yesterday, sustained sustenance in terms of the necessary faculty, faculty advisors, counselors, technology equipment, where's the micro computer lab, building maintenance and repairs, an issue as well as classroom supplies and library collection. I think the, what we've discovered as the board committee on finance has reviewed these is that we hear different issues at different campuses. For instance, the Western campus is focused on the need to build its library collections. Another campus is focused on needing building maintenance. I think each and every one of them have some part of this. So I'd like to start with Vice President George Pernsteiner talking a little bit about what he would see with the funds in terms of Portland State University.
Thank you, Bill. For the record, Chair Minnis, members of the committee, my name is George Pernsteiner with Portland State University, and thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. I'm going to talk briefly about recapitalization, which is about a six-bit word that I have never used before today, so you'll have to bear with me if it stumbles across my tongue in funny ways. But basically what I want to talk about are cash reserves, rebolstering programs, and dealing with deferred maintenance. And for me, those are easier things to talk about because you break them down into pieces. First, the issue of cash reserves, which is something that is horrific to most governmental entities. And so I want to explain what we mean and why we are very, very interested and needful of having some reserves. We face, in the brave new world of a market-based economy, enrollment fluctuations which will have direct dollar effects on campuses as they occur. As was discussed yesterday, the corridor of enrollment, which used to buffer us on the downside in terms of holding us harmless from some enrollment loss, as well as hampering us on the upside from having any of the money from those students in order to serve those students, that corridor goes away. And that has two implications for us. The first is that it means that we have to find our investment capital through the money that we generate in order to mount the programs. But secondly, and perhaps more importantly for planning purposes, we have to have reserves to buffer us if that enrollment falls. If you look back over the last 5 or 6 years, on a campus-by-campus basis, it is very common to have a 2-5% fluctuation in enrollment in any given year. Sometimes, as in OIT last year, you'll see growth of 7 or 8%. That's very fast growth, but you also see reductions of 2 or 3% often at campuses. When you no longer have the corridor to buffer you, you have to be careful that you, the institution, have the reserves in order to deal with those. More than 90% of our costs are fixed in the short term. We have tenured faculty, we have fixed-term faculty, who have contracts, which we have to honor. We have debt service on our buildings and on our equipment, which we have to pay. We have assessments from DAS, as does every other agency, which have to be paid. So in the short term, it's very difficult for us to make adjustments to deal with those enrollment fluctuations. So one way to deal with it is to have cash on hand that we've earned in prior years. Last year, June 30th, 1998, we closed the year system-wide with 4.97% of our current education in general and related unrestricted funds in the form of reserves. National norms tell us we should have around 10%, or about twice what we did, and that the bare minimum that an institution should have is around 5% to deal with those same kinds of fluctuations that we mentioned before. The system as a whole may have been close to 5%, which is the bare minimum, but we had two campuses which were down around 2%. 5 years ago, the system as a whole was around 9%. So that in that five-year period, as we attempted to deal with enrollment, which over that period actually increased, and attempted to maintain our faculty so that we could teach more students, we basically ate into the cash which we had on hand going into that period. So that now we're in a situation where we do not have the cash reserves that are sufficient in normal business practice to deal with operations. So that one of the things of recapitalization is to begin to rebuild those reserves on a prudent overtime basis, not all at once. One of the things that emphasizes the importance of doing this is not that we face the normal fluctuations we have had in the past, but also we are in a competitive environment with some new out-of-state competition. People like the University of Phoenix, like Washington State University, others are, in fact, offering programs in our regions that will attract some of the enrollment that normally would have come, perhaps, to us. So we have to be cognizant of that as we mount our programs, cognizant of that as we work through the implementation of the new model. So building reserves is one way that we can prudently deal with market fluctuations in the short term. The second thing that we want to do in recapitalization is to rebolster some programs. This one's more fun. This one, we're talking about things like library holdings. Even though every campus in this system has tried throughout the period of Measure 5 to maintain its library and even increase its library, the cost of library materials has escalated far more rapidly than our ability to pay for them. Part of that is due to an explosion in published materials. There's a lot more out there, and if you are the research library for your region, and I would submit that every one of us serves that function in one part of the state or another, it is your responsibility to have available for your students, for your faculty, for the people of your region, the information that they need in all of the subjects which you cover. The difficulty now, though, is with the explosion of information and the advent of automated journals. Well, we have our electronic journals and electronic databases, which are more expensive than their paper equivalents. Now, you may ask, why would an electronic journal be more expensive than a paper equivalent? Because they don't have to print it and they don't have to mail it. But it is. And since we do not control that market, and have to pay the cost, what we have had to do at each of our libraries is to reduce our subscriptions over time. So one of the things we want to do is to build back our ability to have adequate library resources. We want to fund adequately the enrollment that already is here. As you've noticed, I mean, you had this discussion in the Emergency Board in January with regard to OSU and OIT, for example. Those students are here. Those students need to be served. And part of what those campuses have to do in the next biennium is have the resources to be able to teach those students. The third thing that we want to look at is faculty retention and recruitment. We have tried our hardest to maintain a faculty that is excellent quality at each of our institutions. Roy Arnold and Jack Cooper will talk about that later. I'm not going to discuss that at this point, but part of the recapitalization is maintaining the basis of our faculty. We need to restore advising and student services, as Bill mentioned. One of the things that we at Portland State are committed to under the new model is to serve more students and to serve them better. For us, one of the things that we need to improve, and we know we need to improve, is the area of student services, the area of advising and counseling. And that's an area that we need to build back. And we need to restore our technological infrastructure. The networks and instructional equipment that have become so much a part of teaching and learning, the personal computers which our faculty now need in order to do their work, their instruction, and their research, our student computer labs, our science lab equipment. Those of you who may have attended Portland State back in the 70s and 80s, if any of you did, come back to the science labs. You'll recognize them. They haven't changed. So that the second thing that we need to do is to rebolster our programs in the area of libraries, in the area of technology, in the area of serving the students who are already here, in the area of advising, and in the area of faculty retention. And finally, just a brief word about deferred maintenance. System-wide, we have a deferred maintenance backlog in education and general buildings, basically the things we talk about in this room, of $333 million at the start of this year, about 17% of replacement value. When I met with the Ways and Means Committee 4 years ago, or no, 6 years ago now, we talked about a backlog that was 13%. So basically, over the period of the last 6 years, we have eroded then an additional 4%. Because what we have tried to do is to maintain the number of faculty we could in order to teach the number of students. But one of the things we have not been able to do is to keep pace with building deterioration. Our deferred maintenance at Portland State is $78 million. It's a huge amount of money. Part of it, ironically, is because of some of the buildings which we have. Those of you who are from Portland will recall that two of our early buildings were Lincoln Hall and Shattuck Hall. Do you know how we got them? The school district abandoned them. They said, we don't need these buildings anymore, and they're too expensive to maintain. Portland State now uses them without major renovation, and quite frankly, a big portion of that backlog is associated with buildings which 30 and 40 years ago were already then deemed not to be adequate for the purpose. So we have to begin to address those things because they are still major parts of our ability to serve students. Another issue on deferred maintenance deals with the 1960s and 70s buildings. In the 60s and 70s, we, like everyone else, built 30-year buildings. That was the thinking. The thinking was that at the end of 30 years, the technology would have changed so much, the needs would have changed so much, that we would tear them down and build something new. We don't think that way anymore, but we thought that way 30 years ago. And we discussed that with legislatures 30 years ago. But what happens is that the building systems wear out. The roof membranes fail. The fan motors in the ventilating systems are at the end of their useful lives. The largest part of our campus infrastructure on all the campuses was built in the 1960s and the 1970s. And that's a direct contributor also to the deferred maintenance issue. So as we talk about recapitalization, we're talking about the reserves that will help us then enter more actively into a market that we have. We're talking about rebolstering programs, and we're talking about maintaining our buildings.
Question regarding the reserves. What level do you anticipate in the governor's budget at the end of the biennium in reserves?
Chair Minnis, that will vary from campus to campus. At Portland State, our hope is to add about $1.5 million at that level to the reserve per year.
Okay. And is funding raised, is the funding to raise the reserve level, is it an ongoing cost?
Chair Minnis, once we reach an adequate level, it will not be. But the reserves also serve the purpose of being your investment capital for a new program as well. So they have two functions.
So if you reach 10%, then that would cease then at 10%. If you reach the 10% level, then you wouldn't.
Chair Minnis, then you generally would not replenish the cash reserve. You may have then funds for investment purposes, or you may not have to have that addition each year. We're a long way from that at this point.
Just a point of clarification. Are you saying you're trying to build back up from 5 to 10? Is 10 your goal?
Chairman, Representative Edwards, 10 would be a prudent goal by national standards. At this point, since we're just below 5, I think we're in a situation where it'll take a significant amount of time to make adequate progress, even back to the 8 or 8.9 that we were 5 years ago. So at this point, I don't think we have a defined goal. We just have a direction in which we're going. I can tell you the goal for PSU if you want, and we have set a goal of 8 to 10% is our goal, and we've put that in writing.
Mr. Prince, how long do you expect it to take to reach your 8% goal? Is this a 3 biennium, 2 biennium, 1 biennium?
Chair Minnis, Mr. Bender, at the rate that we would be looking at Portland State, I'm going to do some quick math in my head, which is always dangerous for me. It was about $1,360,000 at the first level, so that about, it would take into the third biennium, assuming that there were no calls on the reserve. In other words, you didn't have to use any of it. Because Portland State is one of the lower reserve campuses at the moment.
Representative Green?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you talked about deferred maintenance, and particularly when you mentioned Lincoln Hall and Shattuck Hall, as a former student of Shattuck, I thought it was wondering if the swimming pool was still there. And I kind of felt like a relic if you're talking about the building decay.
Chair, Minister, Representative Winters, the swimming pool is no longer there. It's being used as a storage area right now, as is the locker room.
It's kind of disconcerting to hear the buildings are decaying that fast. But back to the erosion of the reserve fund, and I know you're saying that you're going to work towards it. Am I correct to assume that you also have the reserve fund in some kind of a growth account in order to earn dollars on those dollars you're seeing there?
Chair, Minister, Representative Winters, our funds are all invested by the state treasurer because we're part of the state's pool. So there is no direct effect to the campus.
Then you do not receive the interest or what's earned on that from the treasurer's office?
Chair, Minister, Representative Winters, no, we do not. But the revenue accrues to the general fund.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I think as you look over the needs that are described here, maintaining a reserve fund is going to be very difficult, especially if there's entrepreneurial activities and competition for students and the need to be presenting new programs more rapidly than in the past, probably. Plus, you know, just these other things that need money for, like deferred maintenance and all of that. It's going to be really hard, I think, to build that reserve. It's going to be very important. Sometimes I think some institutions will have an easier time than others, clearly, in this new model. So that it may well be that when there's serious enrollment declines and there's no reserves, you've got some kind of a crisis that we'll have to deal with, or they'll have to deal with, or a combination of both of us will have to deal with.
Mr. Shepard?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Bruce Shepard, Provost at Eastern Oregon University. It's my pleasure this morning to provide you with the perspectives of a regional institution on issues that we've been discussing this morning. I'm going to start with a tuition freeze, which is a part of the package. And this is very important for regional students, for those at Eastern Oregon, for several reasons. We represent a region, we serve a region that has not shared in the economic growth of the state of Oregon. We have low median incomes, we have the highest unemployment rates in the state. 80% of our students are on financial aid at Eastern Oregon University. And they leave Eastern with high debt loads. We only know the debt loads that they accrue through financial aid. Of course, they could be taking on debt in other ways, but that's debt in the area of $15,000 to $16,000 per graduate. Adding on top of that, additional tuition would be a major burden. These are students who largely come from first-generation college families. That is, they are the first in their family to make the investment in getting a baccalaureate degree. They're investing their time, their energy, their families are. They're investing already significant financial resources. And a tuition freeze would put a major additional, or the tuition freeze is intended not to create additional burdens upon these students in order to provide for financial access. I wish to turn to the subject of regional access. This is, of course, Eastern Oregon University's
principal mission is to provide access to the 10 counties of eastern Oregon. I have heard people argue that the day of the regional institution is gone, that with virtual education and the ability to deliver courses anywhere, you no longer need regional institutions. From my perspective, this is based on a very faulty understanding of what it is that a regional institution is about. A regional university is not designed to build walls around a region and seek to meet all the needs in that region and keep other players out. A regional institution that really understands its mission sees that its job is to have its ear to the ground, to understand what the needs of the region are, to articulate those, to invite others in then in partnerships to meet those needs. And you always will need a regional institution there to understand that region and see that its needs are being met. At Eastern, we do that through many partnerships. We have partnerships with the Oregon Health Sciences University, with Oregon State University, with Blue Mountain Community College, with Treasure Valley Community College, with Central Oregon Community College, with Mount Hood Community College, with Temecula Community College. We have partnerships with private institutions such as Lewis and Clark. We have partnerships with other state system institutions, every other state institution, state system institution. I won't list them. We have partnerships with out-of-state institutions such as the University of Idaho and Washington State University. When I had the pleasure of meeting with you 2 weeks ago, I described the way in which these partnerships work, how we work with the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, to develop a gaming management program to meet the needs of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla. That's an example of what a regional mission means when it's properly understood. This requires considerable entrepreneurship to do this. You have to be able to take risks. You have to be able to move quickly. And you have to also be able to educate other institutions who aren't used to doing this sort of thing. But what a regional mission really means to me, I think, is best captured in an experience with a student, a new student, brand new, intimidated sort of freshman that you see during orientation week. And we like to find out why students pick Eastern. And in talking to the student and asking her that question, her answer was very direct and very honest. She simply said, and why she was coming to LeGrand, she wanted to see if she could make it in a big city. Now, she came from Joseph, Oregon. But in that humorous but very true answer is captured, I think, what the state's commitment to providing regional access really means in providing that sort of access for that student. Regional access also means helping be the cultural hub of a particular region. It means working in community development, economic development. It means making sure the region is treated fairly in terms of build out of the state's telecommunications infrastructure. And all that we do. But in terms of the instructional mission, where I want to turn and what I will conclude on is the ability to provide education where people are in a very large region. The area in eastern Oregon is enormous. It's approximately the size of the state of Pennsylvania. It's sparsely populated. We are used to talking to you about what Eastern has done to meet the needs of this region, the investments we've made, the fact that over 25 and 30% of our diplomas go to people who, in theory at least, have not been on our campus. But I'm going to give you 3 examples of what learning anywhere, anytime can mean to the state of Oregon statewide. The first example involves an airline pilot. In his words, he needed a baccalaureate degree to move up to a better airline. He happened to be living in the Portland area. And I asked him, well, why did you pick Eastern with all the choices available to you? His answer was that Eastern was the one institution that allowed him, not his words, learning anytime, anywhere. His words were it allowed him to do his course while he was on layover in Atlanta or while he was in Minneapolis. That's what it meant to him. Second example, McDonald's Corporation, by the nature of its business, brings in people who do not have baccalaureate degrees or any college education. The highly motivated, bright people move into the corporate structure. They get training from the corporation. They get lots of experience in business. They need a baccalaureate degree to move further. McDonald's corporate headquarters in Lake Oswego picked Eastern to be its baccalaureate degree completion institution. And I asked the corporate VP, well, why Eastern? You can pick anywhere in any institution in the country, all these virtual entities out there, what have you. And the answer had several components. It was the ability to count the business experience for credit. It was ability to count the corporate training for credit. But primarily it was learning anytime, anywhere. What this vice president told me is our employees were often in crisis mode. We cannot have people guarantee that they'll be free any particular evening or even on weekends. We can't guarantee that they can be in a particular place at a particular time. They need to be able to complete their degrees at any particular time, any place. That's why Eastern was picked. Final example is an individual who, out of high school, entered the family business. And it was a natural resource-based business, and this person saw sort of the handwriting on the wall, as well as the desire to move into other areas, to move into a profession. This person did a very careful study of the opportunities available. The person is in Willamette Valley, decided to go with Eastern. And in 11 concentrated months, while continuing to work for that family business, in 11 months, that person had a baccalaureate degree, having never taken a college credit prior to that. They had a lot of life experience they could count towards that degree and a lot of hard work. A month later, that person had entered Lewis and Clark, completed their law degree, and is now a very successful lawyer. It was very moving about 6 months ago. That person, having graduated years before, stepped foot on the Eastern campus for the very first time, one of our alumni of whom we're very proud. That's an important part of regional access and learning anywhere, anytime, what it expands to. It's an important part of the entrepreneurial activities and risk-taking that we are about, that we believe this new model will enable us to do in the future, the sorts of needs of this state that can be met by that kind of spirit. I'm going to talk in a few minutes again about the subject of recruitment and retention of faculty from the perspective of a regional institution. Before I do that, Provost Arnold is going to speak.
Thank you, Bruce. The Chair of Minutes and members of the Education Subcommittee, my name is Roy Arnold, Provost and Executive Vice President at Oregon State University. My comments today will be from the overall perspective of my experience in higher education. That includes nearly 32 years as a faculty member at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln initially, and also as a department chair and a dean director for the Agricultural Experiment Station, a vice chancellor for agriculture, and then for the last 12 years at Oregon State University as dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences, and for the last 7.5 years as provost. And I also want to note up front that the examples that I will use are from my experience at Oregon State University, but I want to note that similar examples and experiences can be cited for all of the Oregon University System institutions. Slide 8 notes some points that I want to highlight. First of all, on this slide are two shared goals of Oregon University System institutions. One is to keep more of the higher quality students in Oregon, and secondly, to produce more employable graduates in high demand areas. A key consideration to achieving these goals is to provide high quality programs, which are characterized by a strong curriculum, which is planned in partnership with our stakeholders, to provide a strong general education component, which deals with basic knowledge and skills, and the specific knowledge and skills for a given major field or discipline, plus opportunities for experiential learning for our students as part of the overall educational program. All of this happens because of faculty, and offering high-quality programs requires high-quality faculty. All Oregon University System institutions seek to hire and retain strong faculty who will be successful in the performance of their assigned duties and responsibilities. For Oregon State University, this translates to hiring competent individuals as teachers, advisors, research scientists, and other creative scholars, extension specialists and agents, librarians, counselors, or other roles. And then secondly, supporting their overall professional development, and thirdly, retaining those who are effective and productive in these roles. The recruitment of new faculty occurs to replace faculty who retire or otherwise leave the university, or when there is an opportunity and a need to expand capacity in targeted program areas in response to enrollment demand and demand for graduates. As already mentioned in the reference to the consideration by the Emergency Board in January, Oregon State University's enrollment has increased by 859 full-time equivalent students this biennium over the beginning level budgeted enrollment level. These increases were noted particularly in engineering, where we have more than 300 additional students, business, natural resources fields, education, and other areas. It's important to note that new students in any program impact demand for course and laboratory sections not only in the major fields that they choose, but also in science and liberal arts courses that are major components of the general education, or in OSU's case, the baccalaureate core requirements for all majors. OSU's status as a Carnegie Research One university is attributable to the success of faculty members in the competitive grants arena. As highly successful faculty retire or otherwise leave the university, it's important to hire new and replacement faculty who can compete successfully for competitive research grants. In hiring new faculty, all Oregon University system institutions compete with other higher education institutions and in many discipline areas with the private sector as well. I want to refer to slide 9, which presents data for the three largest Oregon University universities, average salaries in comparison to the peer group of institutions for these three universities. And what is immediately noticeable is that often we find ourselves at a competitive disadvantage in competing for top faculty. Would add to this, this only is a comparison with other academic opportunities. The chair of our computer science department indicates that 60% of their PhD graduates are hired by industry, which reflects a national pattern. Hence, the pool of candidates for faculty positions as replacements or to increase capacity of programs is limited, and the competition for their services is keen. Our recent experience at OSU in recruiting and hiring faculty indicates that we've experienced a transition from generally being successful in hiring top choices out of strong candidate pools to a situation where the top candidates from what are still strong candidate pools have multiple offers and opportunities. Again, citing a current example in computer science, the search process identified from a pool of nearly 30 candidates, 10 who were well qualified for the position, 5 of whom were selected for formal interviews. The top candidate is now considering OSU's offer along with 3 other offers, in this instance all from other academic institutions. A candidate in this circumstance is very sophisticated in their analysis of starting salaries, long-term salary potential, startup packages for facilities, equipment, support, which in the sciences and engineering often require a substantial investment. And these candidates are very good at leveraging their favorable bargaining position. Let me switch to a second topic, and that is retention of faculty. Referring again to the data on Oregon University System and peer universities' salary, and in this case, data presented on the last 3 pages of the packet that you have been provided, which provides more detail. If one spends some time and looks at this information carefully, it reveals a serious salary compression problem for Oregon University institutions, Oregon University System institutions. The difference between the average salaries of experienced and newer faculty is much smaller in the U.S. institutions than in peer universities. Although beginning salaries are lower than those in peer institutions, they are relatively more competitive than salaries for experienced faculty because we must be competitive in starting salaries to have any success in hiring the top candidates for positions. Less competitive salaries over time of service for Oregon University System faculty creates an attractive recruiting ground for other institutions seeking experienced faculty with demonstrated success. Because of the high national and international visibility enjoyed by productive and successful research scientists, OSU has had considerable experience in responding to employment overtures to Oregon State University faculty. And sometimes we win, but other times we lose. I'll mention 2 examples of each of these outcomes. Professor Renee Feiereisen, a young entomology professor regarded as an emerging star, an excellent teacher, a productive research scientist in biotechnology, was hired away by the University of Arizona with a substantial increase in salary and a substantial increase in support for his research program. Stephen Gould, a professor of chemistry, an effective teacher and graduate advisor, a productive research scientist with over $500,000 per year of external grant support, was hired to lead a research and development group in the private sector at double his salary. At the same time, I want to acknowledge the importance of faculty retention funds that have been provided in legislatively approved OUS budgets in recent biennia. In this biennium, OSU awarded varying levels of retention funds to 29% of eligible faculty. Examples where we have retained outstanding faculty include Professor Sherry Pancake in computer science, who is now leading a large complex project to develop web-based access to large scientific databases. I guess to cite how highly this work is regarded, the most significant evidence would be that the National Science Foundation and other federal agencies are supporting this effort at $1.25 million annually, and Professor Pancake was invited to collaborate on 3 of 4 regional networking proposals submitted in national competitions last year. When Cornell University aggressively recruited her, OSU was able to respond with a combination of retention funds and other investments in facility improvements to retain her at Oregon State University. The second example actually includes 2 people, and those are Jane Lubchenco and Bruce Mangi, both professors in zoology, specifically in marine biology, who are also wife and husband, and who began their OSU careers in a job share arrangement, which was their preferred arrangement to accommodate family responsibilities with young children at that time. Later, they moved to full-time appointments. Now, both hold endowed chair positions at Oregon State University and are highly regarded as educators and scientists. The endowed chair support, which came from private gift funds and strategic investments in infrastructure to support their research programs, have allowed OSU to retain them in spite of numerous overtures by other institutions and organizations. Among their achievements, Dr. Lubchenco is an OSU Distinguished Professor, a MacArthur Fellow, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, a past president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and a member of the National Science Board, which is advisory to the National Science Foundation. The combined external support for research programs, which these 2 faculty members administer, was $2 million last year. This year it is $9 million, which includes funds that are shared with collaborators in other research universities. As a final example of the challenge of faculty retention, you may have noted the recent news report of Microsoft's efforts to hire more than 300 top computer science faculty from academic institutions within the next year, and perhaps as many as 500 or 600 over the next couple of years. This comes at the same time that Oregon University system institutions are working to increase capacity in computer science educational programs in response to industry demand for graduates. Expanding capacity will require adding faculty to computer science departments and programs. Private sector demand for these same faculty can only increase the competitive environment that is faced by OUS institutions in hiring and retaining faculty in this targeted program area. Once again, I want to note for the record that the distinct OSU emphasis in my comments is only a reflection of my experience, and that my counterparts in the other Oregon University system institutions could cite numerous similar examples and anecdotes. As a bottom line point, the need for competitive faculty salaries is critical to maintaining strong programs, to keeping more high-quality students in Oregon, and responding to increased demand for graduates in targeted program areas. The recapitalization of the Oregon University system budget is needed to provide more adequate resources and more flexibility to Oregon University system institutions to address faculty salary issues and respond to faculty recruitment and retention challenges. Thank you, and I will return the microphone to Bruce Shepherd.
Could you pause for just a moment?
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a 2-part question. The salaries is one issue. How do we compare with the benefits with the other universities that you have listed here? And also, how is there comparison with private industry, since those are the 2 competitive pieces?
Right. First of all, Representative Winters, let me comment on the latter one. We do not have good data on private sector salary, that is something that analyzes a comparison group for a particular employment category. Only the experience of knowing that we have lost a number of people over time to opportunities with substantial increases in salary. Oftentimes we do not have, unless the individual chooses to share it with us, information about what other benefits are associated with that. In terms of the benefits packages for higher education institutions, that too varies, but if you add up all of the pieces that make up benefits packages and you look across institutions in these peer groups, the percentage of what we call OPE, other personnel expense, that's associated with the appointment of a faculty member for Oregon State University is very similar to the total percentage at institutions that are on this list. I happen to know some of those and actually have considered positions at some of those in prior years and know that that a rate of anywhere from 28 to maybe approaching 40% of the salary in terms of the total benefits package is certainly not uncommon when you look at these kinds of institutions.
I think it would be helpful for us, since, you know, that is a piece of the package, if you will, of salaries is the benefit, if we had those kinds of comparisons. And if you have that kind of information available, it would be helpful for me. I don't know about the rest of the committee, but it is a part of the dollar figure. And
you get that. I'm told by Dr. Angelo that can be provided and will be.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson?
What are the numbers that the system hires? Does anybody have that figure?
Yes.
Chair Minister, Representative Nelson, we have about 3,500 faculty on.
Thank you.
All right.
Could you tell me, of the $5 million in the governor's budget, what can be done with that to apply to salaries, current salaries?
Okay. Could you help me with the definition of the $5 million specifically?
That would be $4 million.
Okay. Okay, first of all, Chair Minnis, the $5 million is a system-wide figure. And assuming that it would be allocated in patterns similar to the past, it would be shared among the Oregon University systems roughly in proportion to what the current faculty salary base of each institution is. And we would then have some portion of that available to use to apply in cases where we were having to try to find resources to deal with an overture to a faculty member. Our preference would be not to have to be in that position, that is, be able to maintain salaries for individuals at a more competitive level so that they are less inclined to say yes on the first invitation to become a candidate. And that's basically how we have tried to use those resources. So it would go to a small number of very strong performers where all indications are that they are clearly, or where the institution is clearly at risk of that person receiving other overtures, and because of a non-competitive salary at OSU, might be inclined to say yes to that first visit.
And what will, just kind of a ballpark, what would the average percentage increase be in a situation like that?
Again, I'd have to go back and look at some data, but this last time we, on the retention allocations, we were able to make some adjustments up to 10 or 11% because obviously it was restricted to a smaller share of the total faculty pool.
Thank you, Representative Bethel.
But not all were at that level. It depends on where they are in relation to peers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question was geared towards where I was going is we're going to have a decision on option package 151, which talks about the $5 million spread around. I guess the presentation talks about how we're below average amongst the peers. And I think the general question is, what I would like to ask is, what happens, how does that move us along to continue amongst our peers? Does that push us, if you're talking, I mean, assume for your institution, that's how you would apply it. That would obviously raise your average up. I guess I'm trying to figure out, how does that move us along the continuum of being more competitive amongst the peers, one, and then two, does the OUS have a target? I mean, as far as where do you want to be, this is just for this line, and obviously you're still going to probably be lagging. Where do you want to be, in the median amongst your peers, or that's sort of a higher question
right.
for you?
I'll make one comment, and then I will turn it over to Bill or Joe in terms of what the target established by the board. My last comment on the importance of the recapitalization of the Oregon University system is that we need additional resources to have the flexibility to address that salary competitive issue. We clearly are not able to do that unless we choose to narrow the focus of our program substantially in order to eliminate numbers of positions and shift resources to the remaining faculty and program. So the recapitalization issue is critical to give us the resources and the flexibility to address our competitive salary situation.
Chairman, this is Representative Edwards. Just to add to it, this past biennium, legislature appropriated $7 million for faculty recruitment and retention. The system distributed that to the equivalency of 1.5% of the average salary. As you heard Provost Arnold speak to that, a smaller percentage of the total faculty that are on campus are affected by that, that allows that percentage to go up to at the high end. Maybe the high end percentage of Oregon State might be different at some other institutions. What we're trying to do over a period, I believe the board back in 1997 spoke to the idea of trying to bring us to the average of our peers over a period of time that would take us out to the biennium 2002-2003. And so what we're trying to do is close that gap over that time period. Now, the challenge in that, obviously, is that if our competitors, if you will, if our peer institutions are moving in the same direction at the same rate, we continue to place money there, but not necessarily close the gap, obviously. So that is the stated goal of the board. Whether or not it's achievable will depend on how much money comes to the university system and how much money goes out to the campuses, and then how our peers behave relative to that. You've heard in earlier testimony, for instance, in California, increased funding for the higher education system, so that means more money going into those campuses in California. Same kind of issue up in Washington. So the competition will continue, I think, both at the peers and at the in business.
Madam Chair. Chancellor Cox, did you want to address that?
I'll bring up my mic. Say the thing slightly differently. This is from the board's actual meeting where we set these goals. Salaries were currently in the bottom one third of all public doctoral granting institutions, and the regional institutions are in roughly the same position. Given our goal, it would require that each Oregon faculty member receive approximately a 2.5% increase each year, more than the average increase of faculty at their peer institution to get to our goal. So obviously our progress is quite slow. We know what the trajectory is. It's quite steep. We're committed to getting there, but it's daunting. We would need 2.5% more per faculty member per year than their colleagues are receiving by way of average to do any gain. Otherwise, we just hold even with our present position.
So I understand. I think what was responded was the $5 million. I'm trying to translate the fact that is the $5 million. Then you're saying there's 1.5% over, so you're still 1.5% behind.
That was you're saying.
Think of it.
You need $10 million to basically do what you're stating goal. Is that what you're saying?
Think of it these terms. For each 1% increase in staff salaries, you need at least $3.5 million, Bill. I think it is, per year.
Okay.
And so we're behind. We're behind by that much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Beck.
Thank you, Chairman. It's obvious that faculty salaries in the regular system are lower than average. I'm wondering, do you have any statistics on the turnover rate among the faculty here in the OU system, and how that rate compares to the turnover rate, say, of your peer institution?
We have that for the system. No, we don't.
We have it for each institution. It varies by institution. We can assemble that data. Chairman, Representative Packman, we'll provide that to you.
Thank you. I enjoy statistics, so that would be helpful.
It varies, and it varies by year. I think one has to look at that on an accumulated basis. What has been the pattern, say, over a 4 or 5 year cycle, rather than try to look at a single instance, a single year.
Senator Gordon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was listening for the percentage of the $5 million that will be spent on retention and then the percentage that will be spent on recruitment. Can you talk about the dollar amount in those terms? Are the dollars targeted at that one?
In that Senator Gordley, in the $5 million, I'm not certain there's any targeting in that for, it's just that it's identified for both purposes. Mm-hmm. As we distributed the funds this past year, and I mentioned to some 29% of the total eligible faculty, the great majority, in other words, 73% went to retention, balance went to recruitment, but frequently that was retention related because it was to respond to some serious workload issues for faculty in units that have experienced substantial enrollment increase or had experienced in that unit a significant number of faculty retirements and had shifted the burden of the workload to smaller numbers of faculty, and if we did not respond to that, we would have lost other faculty. And so although it was recruitment, there was still a retention relationship to that investment.
I understand, and what I was trying to get at is, do you know now what percentage of these dollars need to be spent on retention so that we don't lose the good people that we've been hearing about? Retention in my mind means increasing the salaries of some of the current people we have so that we don't lose them. Right. What percentage is that?
My response as an individual, there will be a process. We will have discussions with deans and department chairs and others to come up with a set of guidelines. Going into that, my inclination would be a very simple guideline. It's all for retention. Because that's a serious problem for us. And we'll probably come out with a very high proportion of it for retention.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm speaking generally here, but it looks to me like the more unlivable a region tends to be, the higher the salaries are. And even on that list, I was thinking, you know, Hayes, Kansas is not a great place. And there are some other places such as Flint, Michigan, and here, Buffalo, New York. We know how livable our area really is. Does that do we tend to use that to our advantage by necessity in these situations?
Yes, Chairman, Representative Wilson, they use it in every way they can to recruit people from those unlivable places like Fredonia
mm-hmm.
To come here, and they it is not quantifiable. It's done in terms of the visual and instances of showing how good it is to live in Eugene and Corvallis from personal experience.
I'd like to relate back to an anecdote also. Many years ago, I chaired a faculty salary committee at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and was invited to appear before the legislature to talk about this same issue. That which was followed by an editorial in the local paper by one of the writers indicating how faculty should appreciate all the wonderful things they have in that environment, in the academic community, in a place to live, et cetera. To which I responded with an op-ed piece and identified that almost everything that this person had cited is available at almost every other institution that might approach them. Yes, there are things about the environment in Oregon, but there are nice things in lots of places, and particularly if there are exciting programs and stimulating colleagues with whom to interact. I think academic faculty will find those opportunities very appealing.
One more question. Representative.
Thank you. Just for the record, better understand the marketplace for faculty is, do you compete as well against private institutions in Oregon? Is that another? My assumption is it's a pretty big pool out there, and you're competing not only amongst your peers, but pretty much anybody that's in higher ed in that business. Is that true?
Mr. Representative Edwards, the response would be yes. We compete against all higher education institutions, not just Oregon, regionally and nationally as well.
Public and private.
Right, and public and private.
Is private salaries pretty much matched in private institutions?
I do not have good data on private institution salaries.
We can provide that data, and they tend to be, at particular institutions such as Cornell and MIT, they'll be higher than the numbers you see there. I would make one additional quantifiable point on Representative Wilson's question is that in the last few years, the price of housing in Oregon has gone up considerably. So when an individual moves from upstate New York to Oregon, you face some sticker shock in terms of the price of housing in places like Eugene and Corvallis. So that's a changing pattern from where it was in the late 80s and the early 90s.
Okay, we have about 15 minutes.
And I think in the interest of time, we're going to switch to Dan Williams so that he has adequate time for his comments. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Dan Williams, and I'm chair and members of the committee. I'm the vice president for administration at the University of Oregon, and I have occupied this position for 14 years. What I'd like to do in my few minutes this morning is share with you some observations of changes that we've experienced during that period of time in terms of the kind of learning environment that we have for our students and our faculty. Say a word or two about the campus generally as a learning community, and then I want to mention a word or two about the importance of having an effective support staff, which is the portion of the university that occupies most of my time and attention. Let me simply say that I think all of you know that technology has been introduced in a very big way in instruction processes these years on our campuses, and that has led us to have to modernize in ways that we didn't have to for a while ago. We are teaching a generation of students that have been weaned on visual instruction through the very many multimedia experiences they have in their homes and in their high schools, and we have had to make that adaptation as well. We have faculty members who access the Internet on a very regular basis for purposes of instruction, and of course many of our faculty and our students rely heavily on email networks to communicate with each other and put syllabuses and other references and things of that nature on the web. As George Bernsteiner alluded to earlier, our libraries are no longer just depositories of information, but they really are electronic gateways to libraries and other resources of that nature throughout the entire world. So, in essence, the new learning environment today is really very much a high-tech enterprise, and of course that requires significant investment in equipment and training faculty to use the equipment effectively and to train faculty how to create multimedia teaching materials and to provide the technical support that is required to maintain these rather elaborate high-tech systems. As to the change in the nature of our learning community, I think it's simply easiest to say that there's a significant change in the expectations the students and faculty have for what their university experience would be like. They expect, with the increased cost in education, if they make this investment, that there's going to be comparable increase in the value to them. And that happens in a couple of ways. There's an expectation that if they're paying a great deal of money for their education, that the quality of the experience will match that investment. And they expect that once they finish their college education, that they will be sufficiently qualified to be very successful in a very competitive economic marketplace when they look for a job. And there's a consumer attitude about education today that is new among students and new among parents and puts a tremendous amount of pressure on us to see to it that we can meet that quality demand and that we can provide the capacity for those students to be successful when they leave the university and join the economic marketplace. I might also add that sort of parenthetically, there's quite a change to the demography of student bodies these days. The traditional 18 to 22-year-old student body simply doesn't exist on any campus in the OUS system these days. And as a consequence of that changing demography, we find there's great demand and expectation for a wide array of services that simply weren't important to students as short a time as 10 or 12 years ago. We have part-time students, we have single parents, that results in a requirement for child care services for them to be able to take advantage of the experience. And of course, there's a whole long list of mandated requirements from federal and state government that have to do with disabled students and other members of our student body that adds to the cost of managing the institution. But finally, let me just say a word or two about the importance of competent and effective support staff. In order to meet some of the expectations that I've just talked about, and for our support staff to provide our faculty and students with the kind of assistance they need to be successful in this high-demand environment now, requires us to see to it that we have competent and well-trained people supporting these activities. One of the unique characteristics of the institutions of higher education, not just in this state but elsewhere, is that we're all, in many ways, small municipalities. And we have an extraordinary wide array of occupational positions that need to be maintained. It's not simply a matter of maintaining facilities or processing business transactions. We have food service workers, we have people in the building trades, we have planners, we have environmental engineers, security officers, physicians and nurses in student health centers, a whole wide array of job occupations, all job occupations that are in the private sector. And if we're going to maintain the level of competence required to be effective in supporting our faculty and staff, then we have to be in a position to compete effectively in the private sector for people to staff these positions. And to have an effective workplace, of course, we need to continue to have the capacity to practice the principles of modern management. And that means that we need to be prepared to make investments in training, and we need to create an environment for our employees that provides incentives and awards for achieving success. And later in the day, there'll be some discussion, I know, about Senate Bill 271. And let me simply say, as a practitioner of the administrative side of the institution, Senate Bill 271 has been a real blessing to us. It has allowed us to achieve things that we could not have achieved otherwise. So let me simply say, we manage our enterprise today in a highly competitive environment, and we need to have the resources that are required to meet the changing expectations of our students and faculty and to maintain the degree of quality that brings the benefit that citizens of this state deserve. Thank you very much, and it's my pleasure now, I think, to pass the baton on to Dr. John Cooper, a professor at Poland State University, who chairs the Faculty Interinstitutional Senate. It's
a terrible burden to be asked to speak for all of the faculty.
Well, yes, I will do my best. Madam Chair, I am John Cooper. I'm professor of English at Portland State University and president of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate. As has been said, it's a body that represents all the faculties of all the institutions. And I'm speaking on their behalf. If my anecdotes come from Portland State, it's only because that's my experience, but there's similar experiences, as I know, from talking to my colleagues, my fellow senators. At our December meeting, we passed the following resolution. The Interinstitutional Faculty Senate of the Oregon University System is united in supporting full funding of the budget model as proposed by the Oregon State Board of Higher Education to, one, increase access to higher education for Oregon residents, two, preserve and enhance the quality of the learning experience for university students, three, expand higher education offerings to meet critical needs of the state, four, encourage collaboration and partnerships with Oregon's community colleges and the private sector, five, ensure adequate funding for each institution to carry out its mission, and 6, enable each institution to attract and retain excellent faculty. I think that resolution by the IFS represents the willingness of all the faculties to make the new funding model work for the benefits of the students in the state. I think the faculty have got the message that attracting and retaining students will be crucial to the welfare of each institution. One of my colleagues from the University of Oregon observed that this model will make the enterprise more student-centered, and for those few faculty, and I think there are very few, who have not been sufficiently conscious of the need to serve and be available to students, this model may indeed change their behavior. At the same time, we're conscious that the quality of a course or a program cannot be measured simply by the number of students that it attracts. We're conscious, too, of the dangers of academic charlatanism. What used to be known when I was a student, if you'll pardon the expression, as a gut course, a blanket A course that attracts students without necessarily testing or enlightening their minds. Beyond that, just as the governor's task force saw that the smaller regional universities cannot achieve economies of scale and must be given support to survive, so we recognize that some courses and some programs need to be retained that do not attract large numbers of students for a variety of reasons. Courses serve a local need, for instance, or may represent a significant area of study without which a university is not a university. I think the faculty also recognize that such low enrollment courses need to be balanced by high enrollment courses, and that one way or another, the workload will need to be rationally distributed. Because the new model makes it clear what courses and what programs are, in effect, paying their way, the decision process involving the assignment of faculty will be much clearer and more open to critical observation. It will make clear to anyone teaching a low enrollment course, for example, that he or she will have the responsibility of justifying offering that course on sound academic grounds. But we cannot make this model work, I think, without proper funding, and that's why I'm here asking you to fund this model. And let me give you just a couple of insights from my experience in the English Department of Portland State to illustrate the effects of the underfunding that we've been suffering for a number of years. Even before Measure 5, we lost, and with no loss of student demand, we suffered budget cuts and a loss of faculty, both from unreplaced retirements and faculty hired away by better supported systems. And all the while, I have to add that we were adding courses and programs that were particularly useful for the changing economy. We've increased our offerings in technical and professional writing, for example. We know that one important responsibility that our department has to employers and students is in the training of writing. To that end, 4 years ago, we hired a director of writing. She's just been hired away from us by the University of Ohio in Athens. They will pay her $12,000 more a year for a 9-month contract than we were able to pay her for a 12-month contract. I think she left not only because of the difference in salary, but also because several projects she had developed for the improvement of student writing had to be abandoned for lack of funding. When we hire a new member of the department, faculty members go through a time-consuming process, a search that will take time away from their class preparation or other duties. When the new faculty member arrives, he or she spends some time learning about the institution, and the faculty already there spend time mentoring their new colleague so that the new colleague can, for example, know the requirements well enough to be an effective advisor for a student. My point is that each new faculty member represents both an important resource and an considerable investment by the rest of the department. That investment is lost, and the whole process has to be gone through again every time we lose a faculty member. In my particular department, I'm afraid of losing almost the last of a whole generation of faculty in their 30s and early 40s to better-funded, more supportive institutions. It's hard to persuade a faculty member with a young family not to be wooed away under those circumstances. Because of the loss of faculty, our students complain justifiably that classes are too large, and our graduate students complain that having paid graduate tuition, they still have to take classes that are partly undergraduate and partly graduate. So there's nothing wrong with having such classes, but we need more classes specifically for the graduate students who, as present, we don't have the faculty to staff them. My colleagues in other departments at Portland State tell similar stories. In the art department, the studio classes, for instance, are larger than the standards set by the profession.
And in case you think that art is not an economically important field, I remind you that it was a Portland State student, an art student, who designed the Nike swoosh. Our chemistry department lost a prospective organic chemist to Alabama because that state offered a much larger startup funding for his research. Organic chemistry, as you know, is important to training future medical students, and Portland State sends more of its graduates to the Oregon Health Sciences University than any other institution. So when I talk about funding faculty salaries, I'm not talking about the well-being of faculty. I'm talking about access to quality teaching for our students and the quality of our graduates. I'm talking about the waste of faculty time when good faculty leave, time that could be spent teaching, preparing, advising our students, and doing the research that benefits the citizens of the state, or at the very least improves the faculty member's mastery of his or her field. Fully funding the model is designed to bring our salaries up to the midpoint of our comparative institutions, as previous speakers have said, so we can attract and, above all, retain excellent faculty. Well, faculty are not simply concerned about their own salaries. We are troubled that our students' tuition has more than doubled in this decade. We see the results in students who have to work long hours to support themselves and so find it harder to keep up with their studies, and also who have gone deeply into debt. That's why we in the faculty have always supported the tuition freeze. And finally, one matter that has not been mentioned are the low stipends paid to our graduate assistants. Our graduate program in urban and regional planning is ranked among the 10 best in the country, and the city of Portland provides a very attractive laboratory for students interested in urban planning, as you know. Unfortunately, our program loses potential graduate students to richer schools because the stipend paid to its graduate assistants is absurdly low in comparison to what is offered at other schools. Finally, if I can be a little philosophical, like my career is spent largely teaching the writings of dead white Englishmen. I'd like to cite one of them. The 18th century conservative Edmund Burke, who said that public institutions should be regarded as an inheritance, built up and improved over time, an inheritance that imposes a moral responsibility on the heirs to sustain and improve it. Our system of public universities is such an inheritance, and all of us in this room, I think, are its heirs and its custodians. We need to recognize that previous generations created this system, and future generations will need it. We must not, in all conscience, allow this system to deteriorate. I'm here today to say that we in the faculty have accepted our responsibility to make this new model work, but we cannot do it without the proper funding. And that's why we ask you to fund the new model fully, to make it possible for us, the faculty, to serve our students and the citizens of the state better. Thank you.
Just one question before we close. The question is asked, private college is what the faculty is paid compared to private colleges. What about in Oregon State private colleges, colleges located in Oregon? What is the comparison?
I can speak to that from experience. I know, I did teach at Reed. I know where I read, I'd be making considerably more money than I am at Portland State. Reed, at least, and I think Lewis and Clark. I can't speak for others, but I know those institutions, their salaries.
There are national annual salary reports, which we will extract one quickly and provide for you.
Thank you very much.
I couldn't have closed with any better remarks than Jack, and I knew that when I asked him.
Oh.
We'll see you tomorrow talking about partnership.
Thank you very much. Thank you.